Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, we are talking about Cop City with two organizers of the movement to prevent it and co-editors of the new book, No Cop City, No Cop World, Lessons from the Movement. You can pre-order the book, and we will have a link to it at talkworldradio.org. Our guests are Micah Herskind and Mariah Parker. Micah and Mariah, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thanks for having us, David.
Yeah, thank you.
So I don't know who wants the really dumb question, but for people who don't know, what is Cop City?
Oh, gosh. Micah, do you want to go first?
Sure. So Cop City is the name that a broad coalition of activists have given to a proposed police militarization center that the city of Atlanta is trying to build just outside city limits in southeast Atlanta in a part of DeKalb County that is unincorporated. It's been branded as Cop City because not just, you know, and importantly, it's on the site of forest land, of what existed as forest land that, you know, is in the process of being torn down to build this facility. It's been dubbed Cop City by activists because the plans for the facility actually include this mock city block where officers are going to train in all sorts of things, including various, you know, urban warfare, urban control tactics. It was very much, you know, in some ways a response to the uprisings of 2020. And so, yeah, it's this militarized police training center that folks in Atlanta have been fighting to stop for several years now.
Mariah, is that an ongoing effort or has the effort been lost? It sounds like the forest is being destroyed. What's the status of this thing?
I mean, the sad reality is that the forest has largely been clear cut and that phase one of the facility from aerial footage and things like that does look largely complete. I think when we look into the movement, however, like where we've come from in these last 3 years, a number of successes have been, you know, delaying the project for as long as we have. I think the original plans for its opening were in the fall of 2022, and it's still not open yet. And the way that this movement and the synergy between movements for environmental protection, environmental justice, and movements for, you know, police abolition has sort of merged here. It's created a model that's being kind of exported to other cities where similarly, forests are under threat, communities are under threat by facilities like these. So folks can learn from what we've done here and similarly slow down and stop facilities like this that are coming to, I don't know, a city near you.
And that's the case, right? As it says in the book, there are similar projects being considered or proposed or developed all over the United States and beyond, right? Hence Cop World, not just Cop City.
Yeah. So the Cop City proposal in Atlanta actually followed what was known as Cop Academy in Chicago that was built a couple years earlier. And so in a lot of ways, the Stop Cop City struggle, you know, picked up a lot of the lessons from the No Cop Academy struggle. And our hope is that, you know, through this book and through, you know, the many different ways that, you know, organizers and activists are sharing information about the Stop Cop City movement, people will be able, you know, to pick up some of these lessons. They are being proposed all over the country. Some look more like, you know, official Cop Cities. There's a bunch of different proposals and a bunch of different models. Many are like enormous and even bigger than the one that's being built in Atlanta, thinking of like Baltimore especially. And so, yeah, these are being proposed all over the place.
Are these all for police or are they for military or is it getting hard to tell the difference?
Getting a little hard to tell the difference, I would say. I mean, the one in Atlanta, it's formally dubbed the public safety training facility, as it does include things like a burn tower for, you know, firefighters to learn, you know, or, you know, practice those tactics necessary for their job. But also at the same time, I think there is a way in which like the cover of general, you know, public safety response is used to kind of mask the fact that a lot of the training the police are receiving, a lot of the equipment that they're using in the streets right now, it's highly militarized. Like you said, the lines blurring somewhat in between what is police, what is military. I think that is one of the threats that these facilities are bringing. It's an opportunity in many communities for them to skill up what they need to push back on uprisings like we saw in 2020 and are likely, you know, on the horizon given the state of the politics today?
Yeah. And I mean, one of like the selling points that the Cop City proponents have continually pushed is sort of the ability of Atlanta to then contract out this space and use it for training, you know, use it for collaboration with departments across the country. You know, Georgia already has partnerships with various militaries, including the Israeli military through the GILI program. And so, you know, we don't know exactly how it's going to be used, but it's clear that there will be these sorts of collaborations.
Well, the book is very thorough and detailed and goes into a deep history of this thing in Atlanta, including the context of Atlanta as the most unequal and most surveilled and so forth city in the United States. Why Atlanta? What made this happen in Atlanta and not somewhere else?
Well, I argue in my chapter, kind of like outlining the funders behind Cop City, that so one of the things that made it uniquely plausible here was the corporations that are headquartered in Atlanta that actually funded large parts of the project. So the project is actually run by the Atlanta Police Foundation, which is not an arm of the government. It's a you know, a nonprofit private entity that gets its funding from philanthropy from various, you know, individuals or corporations, most of whom are based in Atlanta. And so the ways that corporations based in the South in particular have been uniquely able to exploit their workforces, amass huge amounts of wealth that they can then reinvest into projects like these are part of why I think that the South was a uniquely like fertile ground for the first, you know, facility of this kind, the largest facility of this kind to be built here. But I think, I don't know, Micah, if you want to talk some about like Rayshard Brooks and some of the other uniquely Atlanta context in the uprising then. Made this so possible.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so I think that in Atlanta, there were already, going into the uprisings, there were already various sort of like activist and organizer experiments with, you know, radical direct action. After Rayshard Brooks was murdered by the police outside of a Wendy's, there was sort of a takeover of that area, and the Wendy's was burned to the ground. And, you know, there was sort of there was an occupation established there. And so I think that they saw people rising up in Atlanta in particular, like some buildings were smashed and, you know, some cop cars were burned. And I think there was a real sort of militancy in Atlanta that I do think that Cop City is a major response to. And so I think that they definitely saw what was happening. They saw Atlanta as one of the sparks for these nationwide uprisings. And then also, you know, something we go into the book is a lot of sort of the specific Atlanta context where, you know, there was this municipal secession movement, not to get too in the weeds, where basically like the white wealthy part of the city was threatening to secede if, you know, Atlanta didn't get things under control. And so, you know, beyond sort of Cop City as a way to beef up the city's like military police capacity, I think it's also in Atlanta a way for the city to signal to corporations, for the city to signal to, you know, white economic elites and, you know, upper middle class residents that, you know, they're taking those people's concerns seriously and they are going to deploy the police, you know, to quell unrest.
And there was a history of this in the book going back, including the Olympics coming to Atlanta, and not to mention it being, you know, in the heart of the former Jim Crow South of the United States. Those sort of divisions have to be part of this, right?
Yeah, and I would say like the hidden unity is also part of it, because Atlanta is like a quote unquote progressive bastion in the South, in, you know, what other parts of the country might view as very regressive, very like clinging onto that legacy. This partnerships between you know, the business class, who, you know, may like, you know, they pretty much just do whatever they need to protect their, you know, bottom line. But then, you know, people like the Democratic mayor, Andre Dickens, you know, Democratic Congress people who have stayed silent as, you know, environmental activists have been charged with domestic terrorism, and one of whom, you know, murdered, whose birthday is coming up this weekend. This sort of like quiet alliance of people who seem opposed given like the polarization of politics in the country, but actually behind the closed doors do have a shared interest in protecting, like Mike was talking about, like the interests of, you know, the wealthy folks in Buckhead, and ultimately do have this alliance that you know, protects the status quo.
Can you talk a little about the importance of them murdering this one activist to the movement, and also where people stand with these outrageous criminal charges?
Yeah. So, some context for people is that one of the this has been a really sort of diverse and multi-tactical movement. There's been, you know, tactics from sort of like the most traditional, like go to city council, contact your representative, march, petition, those sorts of things. But then there's also been, you know, very sort of militant forms of direct action where for over a year, people were occupying the forest where, you know, Cop City is proposed to be built. And, you know, there have been various like anonymous attacks on, you know, various forms of infrastructure involved in destroying the forest. And it's been really decentralized in that sense. Sorry, I just forgot the question.
Well, the killing of this young man.
The killing. So during the phase of this forest defense in January 2023, there had been sort of a series of escalating raids on the forest where joint task forces of police were sort of marching into the forest, trying to round people up. Initially, people were more so getting like trespass charges and things that you would sort of more expect. But increasingly, those raids became more and more militarized. And then in January 2023, this joint task force, you know, this really small army went into the forest and murdered a forest defender known as Tortuguita. And, you know, I think as so often happens when the police murder somebody, it was so devastating and so awful. And it also became sort of a rallying point where a lot of attention poured into Atlanta. A lot of people, you know, sort of woke up to what was happening with this movement, and a lot of support flowed in. And so I think it definitely, you know, in the most awful and tragic way, had a real catalyzing effect, and also led to, you know, these various charges. So right now there are 61 people facing RICO charges, which are basically conspiracy charges. And these domestic terrorism claims are a part of that. And I think a lot of people are recognizing that, you know, these are blatantly political charges. These are not about, you know, what people have allegedly done. The cops have like rounded up people at random who have been associated with, you know, events just opposing the forest and have put them into this indictment. And so, you know, there's a pretty widespread recognition that these are political charges rather than charges reflecting like any actual behavior that people have engaged in.
Yeah. And to that, I'd love to add that one of the things that was so significant, I think, about the murder of Tortuguita was just the stark contrast to like the spirit of the movement. Like the joyousness of the forest occupation is something that just like the fact that they had music festivals. They had, you know, that they were living communally. They were helping each other out. They're doing mutual aid, and that, and they describe like how, what a positive spirit like the forest occupation had. And so to move from that to suddenly they're closing in on people. They are, you know, rounding folks up. They are destroying the encampments, and they are actually killing someone that was like at the heart of them. I think is why it was so galvanizing in some ways.
Parts of it, this community spirit and modeling a better world, you know, reminded me of the Occupy movement as well as the Black Lives Matter movement. I don't know how many people participating are even old enough. I'm old enough that Occupy seems like 10 minutes ago to me. But was that an actual influence?
Yeah, and actually, one of our contributors writes about some of the links between the Occupy Atlanta movement in the early 2010s and, you know, some of sort of the lineage that this movement stands in. And so I think there are really direct connections. I also think, you know, there is just something, it also made me think of the college campus encampments that happened last spring. And I think there is something about sort of like these communal spaces, an occupation of the forest or of a university campus or of a public park or wherever it is, where like you do sort of come together in a different way and you figure out, how are we going to get food? How are we going to get everyone to the bathroom? Where are people going to sleep? What are we going to do? And I think there is something so powerful about those spaces in beginning to sort of model like, how could things look differently? How are we going to take care of each other? How are we going to take care of ourselves? And so I think that was definitely something that came through across this movement and especially in the occupation.
Yeah, I was really struck even before reading this book when these events were happening by how diverse, how many different groups of people doing different things together. and how well known and supported from far outside Atlanta. How was that done? Because people have local movements all over the place all the time that don't become national crusades with people wanting to go help from 1,000 miles away. How was that accomplished?
Well, pretty early on, you know, folks had done things like speaking tours to go around the country and kind of describe the state of the movement and understand their political analysis to help draw people in. And so I think that that's also why, like, a success of the movement that I think continues because those networks are still active in, you know, struggles in those different places. We have people from here who travel to places like Tucson to challenge powers that are involved in the Cop City, in construction of Cop City here, that may have offices there or, you know, ties to various other places. And so making sure, like, as a part of it, creating this nationwide network early on, I think was one of the movement strengths.
Yeah, I think just to, I totally agree. And I think that what people did such a good job of early on was making clear that, like, this building is being built here, but the interests that are behind it are national and international. And so, like, I think a lot of people understood early on that challenging Cop City in Atlanta is part of trying to prevent Cop Cities from being built in other places. In addition to the ways that, you know, you share tactics, you share knowledge, you share experience. And so I think that there was an understanding that Cop City doesn't stop at Atlanta.
It also seems like you got anti-racist groups, anti-poverty groups, anti-war groups, environmentalists, a Native American nation. I mean, a huge array of interests that don't always work together on something, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And I think that, you know, and that was Atlanta's fault for, you know, I think that they made it so easy to see the connections between all, you know, between all these issues. They built it on the site of a forest. And so the environmentalists were in. This is, you know, land that belonged to indigenous people that was stolen from them, you know, and through the Trail of Tears, through, you know, a long legacy of indigenous dispossession. And so, and there were active efforts to involve, you know, our indigenous comrades who had been displaced from this land. It was done through this really sort of shady process where they didn't have to go through all the accountability mechanisms that they would because it was just slightly outside of city limits. So even like the good government and transparency people were mad about it. Obviously the abolitionists and the anti-police people are mad. So like, they're just like something for everyone to oppose. And I will say that I think early on, people opposed it for very different reasons, but like as people have built relationships, we've also learned from each other. I think the abolitionists have learned about environmental justice and vice versa. And so there's been a lot of knowledge sharing in that sense too.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely came into the movement from like a police abolitionist standpoint and then learned about the like how important environmental justice and climate change are as a part of that project. And then encountering, you know, environmental activists who've been doing it for decades, who now are, you know, going to the RICO trials and like supporting in the defense of folks that are, you know, being unfairly targeted. So I think we all definitely learned a lot from each other, are learning a lot from each other through the ways our interests have intersected.
Yeah.
Do you think a lot of people were educated about not just restraining extreme police abuse and militarization, but police abolition, what that means, what that could look like? Was that sort of education part of this campaign?
I think so. And you know, in both formal and informal ways, a bunch of teach-ins happened, but also through times like when City Hall was packed with you know, hundreds and hundreds of people giving testimony about why they didn't want this facility. There were so many different reasons why people wanted, so many other things people wanted instead of this, that they want healthcare, they want housing, they want safe streets, they want parks. And so the reframing of abolition is also just like investing in things that give life. I think that was so manifest in moments like that, where if you listened to hours of testimony, you heard all these things that we could have instead of a militarized police state. And so I think that was really eye-opening for a lot of folks that maybe came to the movement from different angles, but understood where we were coming from over time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's been one of the most powerful things to me, is that I think that a lot of people involved in the movement in various ways may not describe themselves as abolitionists, but I think that like so many, you go to these city council meetings that Mariah is talking about, and you hear people articulating what I think is an abolitionist vision, saying like, here are the things I want you to invest in that don't include $120 million for this deadly police facility. And so I think that that's been such a powerful thing. And then I also think that, you know, besides the political education and sort of, you know, this articulation of what it is we want, I also think it's been radicalizing for a lot of people just to be in the struggle. I think that, you know, for example, a lot of the environmentalists have seen, you know, whereas maybe they started at a point of like, yeah, it doesn't make sense to tear down this forest. Like, we need this for recreation. We need this for, you know, preventing climate change and flooding. I think a lot of people have seen like, oh, if you want a livable planet, you're going to have to take on the police, because the police are there to serve the interests of capital and, you know, extraction, which is what capitalism does. And so if you want to stop that extraction, you're going to have to take on the police. And so I think a lot of people have actually developed more of a politics around policing just from their own engagement with the movement.
One of the hard parts about building movements is the whole relentless zombie question of violence. You know, the diversity of tactics usually means we do nonviolent stuff plus violent stuff, you know. And often the wisdom seems to be you want to build a bigger movement. It has to be inclusive of all the people who don't want to do violence, which for some people means property destruction. For some people, it just means actual violence against living things. But how do you deal with that in this new age where everybody wears masks and does events where they don't want the media to come and don't want their names known, and they're not trying to build a big inclusive movement, and yet somehow they are part of building a movement? How do you address those differences of strategy?
I don't know if you want to take that one, Micah, but I think that ultimately it's like agreeing together to always help the public understand the way that we are already living in a violent society, that the police response when they are busting into the home of folks that are just providing, you know, bail funds for protesters exercising their First Amendment right, that is violent, that the destruction of, you know, 100 acres of forest, the destruction of entire ecosystems by, you know, construction equipment, that is violence. And so understanding the killing of an activist, the actual murder of a 26-year-old person as the violent system that we are challenging, as a way to just like dispel the myth of like who is violent and who is not. Destroying construction equipment is not the same thing as murdering a 26-year-old person. And so particularly during times of like the referendum, when a lot of the, you know, pro-democracy voting rights groups got involved and other NGOs, just like holding that line of like making sure that we are all, no matter the tactics, if you are, you know, holding rallies, if you're getting signatures on a petition, whatever it may be, all trying to keep our focus on the fact that it is the state that is killing people, that is jailing people, that is destroying human lives.
Well, clearly I agree with all of that 100%, but the fact that somebody's violent doesn't say one word about somebody else being nonviolent. I mean, it just changes the subject. Israel wants to talk about Hamas violence and Hamas wants to talk about Israeli violence. Neither one makes the other guy less violent. You know, they're very unequal, of course, but I don't know. Some movements take a public principled stand. We're going to be nonviolent, and maybe property destruction is okay, maybe it's not, but they do that. Other movements don't. They say we must be open to all things, including, you know, attacking the police, who attack us worse and have bigger weapons than we do, so they're the violent ones. But that's not forswearing violence, right?
I think that part of it is that there's no like, because it's such a decentralized movement, there's no like one body or group who can, you know, either agree with or disavow any sort of tactic, whether it's, you know, framed as violent or not. You know, I wouldn't personally consider, you know, the destruction of construction equipment violent, even if it is property destruction. But I think the point is that, like, because it is so decentralized, you know, in a lot of ways, there isn't anyone saying like this is okay, this isn't okay. It is really sort of this self-initiated thing where, you know, a group of people came together and said, let's do this referendum ballot initiative effort, and we're going to draw a ton of people in that way. And then, you know, other groups or individuals have presumably seen, you know, better ways or different ways to engage. And I think they've done that. And so I think there is, you know, some work on sort of like, you know, when we just have conversations with people of really breaking down these things of like, what tactics are people comfortable with? And, you know, I think a lot of people have discomfort with property destruction, and, you know, maybe understandably so. And I think that that's where we get into the conversation, you know, that Mariah is sort of talking. And I've had a lot of conversations with people where we're just, you know, speaking about like, well, what is the difference between, you know, a police car being burned versus a forest being destroyed? Like, how do we distinguish between those things? And so I think there's a lot of like productive conversation that actually comes out of these moments where people might have an initial discomfort with a tactic that someone is pursuing. But I think a lot of people, I've seen way more support for these things than I thought that I would. I think in part because people recognize the stakes of a forest being torn down, all this money going into a police militarization facility.
Yeah, oh, you make wonderful arguments. I'm just less worried about somebody being comfortable with smashing a police car than with whether or not it's strategic to bring in the people who aren't yet in the movement. But it's a wonderful book, and it makes an incredible case. We've got just 2 minutes left. Important lessons learned. What comes next? What do you want people to know?
I'll say that I think that the biggest thing that this movement has driven home for me is that it is always worth it to keep fighting, because there were so many different points where it seemed like we were going to lose for sure. You know, things are still looking bleak in a lot of ways. We're clear in the book that like, we're not writing this as some victory lap. We're, you know, us and our contributors were writing this as the movement's still unfolding. And in a lot of ways it still is. And we've seen a lot of victories. The facility is smaller than it was originally going to be. A lot of people have been mobilized. A lot of relationships have been built. It's been delayed by years. People have been politicized against the current administration. And so I think that, you know, it's just taught me that time and again, it's worth it to keep fighting, because you never know quite what is going to come of that resistance.
Do you think, Mariah, people are even better prepared to oppose some of the abuses of the Trump administration from having opposed some of Atlanta's?
Oh, yeah, 1,000%, 1,000%. I think people have really learned a ton of different organizing skills through their engagement with the movement. Mm-hmm. I think folks have come to see the way, like the tactics of repression that they will use so that we are better prepared for it. Like Micah mentioned, the relationships are stronger. I've met so many people through the movement. I know countless thousands of us have, that we're going to continue to organize with against Trump as much as we did Andre Dickens. And so I think our current fight back is better for the movement of Stop Cop City having happened.
I think there can be no doubt. The book, if you're watching the video, you can see me holding it up. No Cop City, No Cop World, Lessons from the Movement, edited by Kamau Franklin, if I said that right, and our guests, Micah Herskind and Mariah Parker. Micah and Mariah, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.